didn't want to record all this stuff about my diet.
Might be inspiration for people who are needing it.
We'll see. We'll see.
Yeah, you might have to share that in a bigger forum.
Yep. Okay. This is the Book of Sirach, and it's a fairly long book. It's much longer than the Book of Wisdom, but it falls in that same category of wisdom books. And a lot of people look at it and they say, well, it's just a bunch of little proverbs. It's kind of like the Book of Proverbs, you know. But it's really not. It's got a whole structure. It's got a message and everything. And the Navarre Bible has some really, really good notes on the whole book. So I thought we'd go through those first so we can see, get a sense of what we're going to be looking at and how it's put together and everything. So it says, in the Greek Septuagint version of the Bible and in the Vulgate Latin, the last of the canonical wisdom writings is the Book of Ecclesiasticus. The Book of Sirach is also called the Book of Ecclesiasticus. So some Bibles have it Ecclesiasticus, some Bibles have it Sirach.
And mine says Ecclesiasticus, or the Wisdom of Jesus, the Son of Sirach.
That's another name for it. We're about to get to that, too.
Okay.
Yeah, but you're right. It's had a few different names.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to make sure we knew that, because you might see something that talks about it, and you'll know what it is.
Yeah.
Okay. The work was originally written in Hebrew, but then translated some years later into Greek. And I think it's the son of the guy who originally wrote it that did the translation into Greek.
Oh.
Yeah. Morning, Alan. We're just getting started with this. We're talking about what I'm doing, Alan, right now is going through the Navarre Bible notes about the Book of Sirach, so we get a sense of what it's all about and that sort of thing. So it's also called the Book of Ecclesiasticus, as we said. It was originally written in Hebrew, but it was translated some years later into Greek. Like the Book of Wisdom, which comes immediately before it, it does not form part of the Hebrew Bible. They took it out. Ecclesiasticus has come down to us under several different titles in the Jewish, Greek, and Latin traditions. In rabbinical writings, it is known as the Instruction of Ben Sirach. Ben Sirach is the guy that originally wrote it. Okay. Or Book of Instruction. It's also called the Book of Instruction in the rabbinical writings. In most of the Christian Greek manuscripts, it is called the Wisdom of Jesus, Son of Sirach. Or in a shorter form, the Wisdom of Sirach. Some Latin manuscripts agree with the Greek in calling it the Wisdom of Jesus, Son of Sirach. But from the 3rd century on, it is often also called Ecclesiasticus. Perhaps because of the use made of it in the instruction of catechumens or neophytes. In other words, it's an ecclesiastical kind of book. It goes with the religious instruction and stuff. This last title has been the one most used in the Latin church up to the present time. But Jesus ben Sirach and Sirach seem to be gaining ground. So we see that a lot. The literary genre of the book is the Hebrew mashal, which includes both maxim and proverb or parable. It's kind of a mix of both those things. The book is in poetic form in the broadest sense of that term. The text has a particular rhythm and follows its own syllabic count. In the original Hebrew and to a degree in the Greek version, the phrases are short and emphatic. So he's making short points of instruction that he wants to get across to us. He doesn't go into real long diatribes like some of the other writings do. So what is the structure and content of the Book of Sirach? Although a first reading would lead one to think that it is a heterogeneous collection of maxims and sayings in no particular order, careful perusal reveals it to have a fairly elaborate but not explicit structure. Underlying the structure is a fairly tidy literary and didactic plan. And didactic means it's intended to teach, right? Okay. Especially moral instruction. So one could say that the central idea of the book is given in in verse 15, in chapter 15, verse 1, which says that he who holds to the law will obtain wisdom. So there's a big theme that just goes all through the book about adhering to the law of God, and that brings you wisdom and other good things that happen to you. And that it was written for those who wish to gain learning, being prepared in character to live according to the law. So it's for those who actually want to learn something. It's not just something you pick up and read like a novel. You know, you're looking for learning, you're looking for instruction, you pick this book, and it teaches you stuff. To this end, the structure of the book reflects that of the law, in that it consists of five parts, just as there are five books of the Pentateuch. So he even structured it in five sections to kind of morph over the top of the law. And so you see that, because he talks about the law a lot, about how you keep, if you adhere to the law, you'll gain wisdom. So he structures it to look like the Pentateuch. Each of these parts begins with doctrinal instruction, sapiential theological in style, containing reflections on wisdom and how it is communicated to man. This introduction is followed by a collection of counsels in the form of proverbs and maxims, etc., which are really teachings and practical applications as to how someone should live if he wants to be in line with the divine wisdom that the Lord gives man. The second section in each part tends to be longer than the introduction, and although the themes dealt with are very diverse, the teaching is always in the form of exhortations to the reader to live according to the law of God. So we'll see that theme all through it, you know, follow the law. God gave us the law, therefore he gave it to us for a reason, therefore make use of it, follow it. The five parts are preceded by a prologue that was written by the person who translated the book into Greek, and they are followed by two epilogues. So we can say that the general plan of the book is as follows, the five parts. The first part is God has the fullness of wisdom. And in the introduction, the theme is all wisdom comes from God. So God has the fullness of wisdom. He's the source of wisdom, so he's the one that's got to give it to us. So that's the theme of the first section. And then the second section is God imbues all his works with wisdom. So he is the source of wisdom. He imparts wisdom to all of his works, primarily to man. But also to, you know, he imbues wisdom in all of his creation. And that's seen in the order of the universe and the beauty of creation and all the rest of his stuff, right? And so the introduction talks about wisdom in creation. The third part of the book, God grants wisdom to those who keep his commandments. So if you follow the law of the Lord, he will give you wisdom. You will get that from that activity. So the introduction talks about wisdom and faithfulness to the covenant. He talks about how the law of God was given to us in covenantal form. And when we have that, we follow that, we gain the fruits of that wisdom. The fourth section is the fullness of wisdom is fear of the Lord. And the introduction is all about fear of the Lord. And he makes the big point about what fear of the Lord really is. It's not being afraid he's going to slap you with a hammer or something. You know, it's fear of offending him, of breaking his law. And then the fifth section, the last part of the book, is the lessons of history. The introduction talks about God, the Lord of the world and of history, how God can be seen in his interaction with all of mankind in the history of salvation. And then there's a practical set of teachings on, which is kind of a eulogy of the ancestors, all the good things they did. Then the epilogue is a Thanksgiving hymn. It's very short. It's a Thanksgiving hymn and then a poem on the quest for wisdom. So what is the historical and literary context? How did this come about? When was it written? That sort of thing. In the 4th century BC, at the end of the period when Judah was a province of the Persian Empire, and I didn't know it was a province of the Persian Empire at the time, I guess. Mm. Yeah, we took the Bible timeline thing, but I forgot when That was. But anyway, he says, in the 4th century B.C., at the end of the period when Judah was a province of the Persian Empire, the schools of Jerusalem and the whole region played a key cultural role. One indication of the work that they were doing is the Book of Proverbs, a book containing all kinds of maxims to do with religious and secular wisdom, and which was used as a manual for the instruction of young people and everything to do with life in keeping with the religious tradition of Israel. And we have a thing in Christianity similar to that. That's called the Didache. And that was a book, as the apostles started going around the world, people said, hey, we capture your teachings. So they tried to capture the essential teachings of the apostles in this book called the Didache. We don't know who wrote it. The author is not named. But it goes into all kind of things, including how to conduct yourself in worship. It talks about the Mass and the Eucharist and that sort of thing. And it's an interesting book. But they used to use it when people wanted to become Christian. They used it like an RCIA manual, but they used it on an individual basis. Mm-hmm. So if I were a Christian and you wanted to become a Christian, you would come to me and say, hey, I raised my hand, I want to become a Christian, right? So I would take the Didache and I would sit down with you, use it as a book of instruction one-on-one to teach you what it means to become a Christian. Mm-hmm. And then at the end of that period, you would become a catechumen and then get baptized and become a Christian and receive the Eucharist and all that stuff.
So kind of a first catechism.
Yeah, very much like that, yeah. And so that has the same role that this book of Proverbs did for the Jewish people. Because that Proverbs book was to teach as a manual of instruction for young people in particular, and everything to do with life in keeping with the religious tradition of Israel. Okay, so they kind of go hand in hand. This Alexander the Great's campaign, covering the entire Middle East, produced many cultural and political changes in that whole zone. During the 3rd century B.C., Palestine was under the control of the Lagid Kingdom of Egypt. It was during that time, particularly, that commerce and military establishments were instrumental in spreading Greek language and culture right around the Mediterranean coastline and across the Near East, Palestine included. This had the effect of opening up channels for dialogue between the new culture and the teachings of the tradition of Israel, evidence of which can be seen in the book of Ecclesiastes. So we'll see some evidence of that kind of influence, that Greek influence into the Jewish teaching. And that's one of the things you look for in the book of Ecclesiastes. In the final years of the 3rd century, in the early years of the 2nd century B.C., the Syrian wars between the Lagids of Egypt and the Seleucids of Syria came to an end, leaving Palestine under the control of the Syrian Antiochus III. That king issued various decrees designed to speed up the reconstruction and repopulation of Jerusalem. He granted privileges to the priests, scribes, and members of the Gerousia, or Council of Elders, and made appropriate arrangements for the upkeep of the city and the temple. The net effect of all this was that the holy city was becoming more and more like a large Greek city because of that influence from Alexander the Great and stuff. So you have that influence coming into the Jewish culture, and you see a kind of a mix. The traditional schools of Judah were not unaffected by this invasion of Greek culture and lifestyle, the more so when teachers made their appearance and introduced their disciples to the whole range of Greek philosophical ideas that were being debated in the cultural world of the Greeks. However, this closeness to the world of Hellenism did not lead to a fall off in observance of the law of God, the Torah. On the contrary, the law took on a higher profile as a sign of fidelity to the God of their forebears and a badge of Jewish identity. And thus we have the main theme of the book of Ecclesiastes, or book of Sirach. As it says right in the, adherence to the law is the main theme of the whole book. For their part, in order to deal with these new influences from outside, the priests of the temple had more than a little difficulty in performing their functions with all due dignity. Outstanding among them was Simon the Second, who was a high priest from 219 to 196 BC, and was praised in the book of Sirach. We see that in chapter 50. We don't see him until chapter 50, but he was praised for trying to do the right things. This is the context in the years prior to the persecution instigated by Antioch the Fourth Epiphanes, in which we began to see the first sign of harassment of those who stayed loyal to the law, and when Greek pressure was steadily on the increase. This must have been the time when this work was written. We saw the pressure from the Greeks to influence the law of God, and so they wrote this book. The whole theme is stick firmly to the law of God. Hang in there, don't deviate. It came from God, didn't come from all these Greek gods. It came from our God, which we know is the true God, so follow the law, and you'll get wisdom from that. So that's when this was written, to call people to faithfulness to the traditions of Israel. In it, we can see the author's great regard for the temple liturgy, for the history of Israel, and for the priesthood. The book, moreover, is linked with the sapiential tradition of the book of Proverbs. We find in it some expressions reminiscent of Greek philosophers. So what is the history of the text? Thanks to information given in the prologue of Sirach, it is possible fairly accurately to date and place its author, Jesus, son of Sirach, son of Eleazar of Jerusalem, and his grandson, the Greek translator, not his son, and his grandson, the Greek translator, whose name we do not know. The translator says that he arrived in Egypt and stayed there, probably at Alexandria, in the 38th year of the reign of Eugertes, who was Ptolemy the seventh, that is, in about the year 132 BC. So that's when the translator was in Egypt. From this, we can take it that the Greek translation was made after that date. His grandfather was a teacher of Israel and a lover of learning who devoted himself to the teaching of the law. He himself says that he ran at Beth Midrash, that is, an academy or school for studying the sacred book books of Judaism. It's the guy who actually wrote the original book.
So Jesus does not refer to Jesus Christ.
Right.
It's a name.
It's a name. Jewish. It was a fairly common name, actually, back then.
Okay.
He would have written his book about 70 years earlier, around 190 to 180 B.C., since it seems evident from his text that he was unaware of the tragic events that happened during the reign of Antiochus IV Epiphanes, when the king imposed Hellenization on Israel by force. Moreover, from what he says in chapter 50, verses 5 through 21, he seems to have known Simon II personally. That's the guy who wrote the book, okay? Mm-hmm. The high priest who held office up to 196 B.C. So he's speaking from his own personal spiritual growth, his teaching, his study of Jewish tradition, but also his contacts with the high priest and stuff like that. So his experience when teaching in the Beth Midrash must surely be reflected in his writings. So he was a teacher, and as a teacher he wrote, and he writes as a teacher, giving instruction. The instruction given in those schools was based on traditional maxims, but the style changed a little when they were being put down in writing. In the book of Proverbs, we find very short sentences, very concisely put, one following quickly on another, even if they deal with different subjects. But Ben Sirach, the teacher, develops the idea a little and does to some degree group them by subject in small units, which in turn link up with those before and after, so that the text runs rather seamlessly, or at least without abrupt changes of theme. All the wisdom contained in these proverbs is interwoven with exhortations to be faithful to the covenant, particularly by studying and keeping the law that God gave Israel. The original Hebrew text of Ben Sirach was not included in what is called the Palestinian canon of the sacred scriptures, which gradually became the standard text in later Judaism. This fact had a considerable influence on the transmission. Although the book was appreciated for its content, it was not very widely used, which explains why few early copies are extant and their quality is imperfect. In Jewish writings of ancient and medieval times, only some 100 or so quotations or allusions to Ben Sirach have been found. St. Jerome says that he did not see a copy in Hebrew, but he did not translate it for the Vulgate. He took an already existing translation and put it into the Latin Vulgate. I thought he had translated the whole thing, but apparently he did not translate this particular book. Scholars began to become familiar with the Hebrew text from 1896 onwards, the year that saw the publication of a folio of a 12th century manuscript recently discovered in Egypt. So it wasn't until 1896 that they discovered this. And so everybody got excited about it, so they started studying it. In the years that followed, fragments of five other medieval manuscripts were also discovered, and then much more substantial pieces of the book were found in the rolls of Qumran and Masada, the Dead Sea Scrolls. Dating from the 1st century BC and the first half of the 1st century AD. All this discovery and research means that today we have a Hebrew text which contains about two-thirds of the text conserved in Greek and Latin. The Greek text has come down to us by a number of different routes. From earliest Christian times, it has been conserved in the Greek codices of Holy Scripture. It is available in two recensions, that means revised editions. One of these is somewhat shorter than the other. Sirach is found in the Unical Codices of the Septuagint, the Vatican, the Sinaitic, the Alexandrian Codexes of the 4th to 5th century. Unical is a form of writing, rounded, unjoined capital letters found in ancient manuscripts. And in some very important minuscule codices, the beginning of the 9th century saw the development of a lowercase minuscule cursive script that joined up the letters or words. So they're talking about two different ways it was written. Mm-hmm. The way, no printing press, of course, so everything was handwritten. Mm-hmm. But they're talking about the ways that people wrote in two different ways in two different times. And that had an influence on what the document looks like when you read it. Yeah. So you got to know where those were when you try to translate it so that you can understand.
And
what
it
they
just
were doing.
Ran on and on. And
it did on and on, yeah. It just, you know, so you had to figure out where the punctuation should go, and, you know. And you know, there's always a joke about how important punctuation is, you know. What are we having for dinner, mother? What are we having for dinner, mother? So the type of this text, the one in this book, is the one that has become the textus receptus used for printed editions of modern times. The other recension, which is 134 verses longer than the textus receptus, is conserved in many Greek manuscripts and also in quotations from it in the writings of ecclesiastical authors and fathers of the church, most notably Origen's Hexaplar edition and Lucian's recension. In the 2nd century AD, a translation into Latin was made in the West. This forms part of the Vetus Latina Latin Bible. It is a translation made from the longer of the two Greek texts, and it also contains additions or explanatory glosses not found in the Greek. St. Jerome did not translate the text of Sirach. He simply took the Vetus Latina version and put it into the Vulgate. This is the version that was used in the Latin liturgy and by Western fathers and spiritual writers. The official text of the Latin Church nowadays, the New Vulgate, has taken as a norm the version that found its way into the Vulgate, retouching it here and there with an eye on the Greek version and on the fragments that survive of the Hebrew. However, the New Vulgate has retained from the earlier Latin version the odd word, phrase, or verse absent from the Septuagint, and which serves to clarify the meaning of that text in the light of the Christian faith. The complex history of the text of Sirach explains why this is one of the least fixed texts in the entire Old Testament. because they had all these different versions and translations and stuff. Mm-hmm. However, despite the variations and discrepancies, the substance of the text is not affected, even though some passages are translated very differently from one edition to another. But the message is the same, just how you translate the message. For the Spanish edition of the biblical text, the editors of the University of Navarre follow the longer of the two Septuagint Greek texts, while also taking note of the available fragments of the Hebrew original. They retain the additions that the new Vulgate retained from the Vulgate. They also use the verse numbering of the new Vulgate. In our edition, the Navarre Bible, we keep to the RSV verse numbering. Bold verse numbers in the inside margins will help the reader who wishes to relate the RSV text to Latin. So when you actually read this book, you see the verse numbers, you see a bolded other verse number that's referenced to the other thing. Mm. So if you want to do a comparison, you know where to go and what verse to look at. I'm really impressed with this Navarre Bible. It's really, really well done.
Great.
Yeah. So what is the message of the Book of Sirach? The Book of Sirach, which is quite long, contains a large number of wisdom maxims deriving from many different sources. However, it is not a motley collection of sayings. It is one of those works in which the Holy Scripture indicates with remarkably clear cues how deeply related are the knowledge conferred by faith and the knowledge conferred by reason. And we saw this also talked about in the Book of Wisdom when we went through that, if you remember. It talked about how we can find God through both reason and through faith. And of course, that's how Aristotle came to his conclusions about God, which had an influence on St. Thomas Aquinas. Ben Sirach, steeped in the wisdom tradition of Israel, tries, like Plato, to reach the higher things. But although he applies his mind as best he can, he is aware that the really important things have to be studied in the light of the divine wisdom given to men. That is, reason enlightened by revelation, which is, in fact, what Christian theology does. So he was trying to use the revelation given to the Jews up to his time. And so we take that, and then we add on to it the revelation given by Christ, the fullness of revelation, to take this wisdom and then add to it the wisdom that Christ imparted in our Christian theology. In line with what Proverbs 1:7 says, Ben Sirach starts out from the idea that to fear the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. He says that right off in chapter 1, verse 14. Fear of the Lord, meaning the acknowledgement of the transcendence of God, his governance over created things, and the fact that he repays each person in accordance with his deeds. So that's the idea behind the fear of the Lord. You know, live a good life, and he will reward you according to your good life. But Ben Sirach's main contribution, as compared with earlier sapiential tradition, is that he combines that wisdom obtained through observation of nature with rational reflection on the wisdom that God has made manifest in creation, in the history of Israel, and particularly in his law, which he revealed to man through Moses. By doing so, he sets wisdom in the sense of a gift from God and an activity of man. He calls wisdom both things. It's an activity of man and a gift from God. Into the framework of the covenant God made with his people. The very best sort of wisdom is the law of Moses, the Torah, written down in a book. And the wise man is he who knows the law and puts it into practice at all times by applying human reason to it. That's where the Pharisees and the scribes went off track, because they tried to put excess human reason into the law, ended up with a bunch of ridiculous rules that Jesus was always castigating them for. Mm. You know, like you got to live within 120 paces of the synagogue, otherwise you can't do anything on the Sabbath and all crazy stuff like that. You can't help somebody, because that means you're doing work, you know, Sabbath. Mm. So You know, so he says we have to apply human reason, but do it in the right way. Don't go nuts over it. Therefore, over the course of each of the five parts of the book, Ben Sirach propounds theoretical or speculative ideas about wisdom and also spells out how these apply in real-life situations. So he's not just talking philosophy. He's giving you practical advice to use in your daily life. Mm. This introduction is not the place to go into all the details of the wide range of subjects dealt with in the book, but they give a brief list of the main subjects. Firstly, and as a backdrop to the whole book, there is the exhortation to seek divine wisdom. Then he moves on to talk about fear of the Lord as the beginning and the climax of true wisdom. Then he talks about sin and conversion to God, the need for everyone to be humble. He talks about life and death, relationships between human beings, friends, parents, children, rulers, and ruled, truthfulness and falsehood, control of your tongue, free will, etc. Still, there are three subjects that deserve special attention. Divine retribution, or is live a good life, or you pay the consequences, right? Actions have consequences. Mm-hmm. The importance of religious worship and God's providence toward Israel throughout its history. So the idea that God is always watching over us, always leading us, always inspiring us, always protecting us. Mm. But we got to cooperate with that if we're going to live the right life. Ben Sirach tackles the whole question of divine rewards and punishments and is familiar with the problem of the just man who suffers. And with that, we find him saying repeatedly that God rewards man at the end of his life. So don't expect great rewards in this life. And of course, Jesus talks about that too. Mm-hmm. In the parable about the beggar Lazarus and the rich man, how Lazarus ends up in the book of wisdom, and the rich man ends up in hell. Mm. So that the same concept is on here. Okay. But he does not spell out what that reward consists in. It may be the circumstances of his death, for example, at what age he dies, or what illness he dies from, or the memory he leaves after him, good reputation, etc. Nowhere in the book does it expressly look forward to a life after death. That was something Jesus really introduced us to, because he talked about heaven a lot. He says, what is heaven? Heaven can be compared to the mustard seed, you know, and heaven can be compared to this, and heaven can be compared to that. He taught us a lot about what our life in heaven is like and what heaven should be.
But some of them did believe in an afterlife.
Well, they believed in an afterlife, but they didn't know what it was.
Because
in their tradition, everybody went to Sheol, waiting for the Messiah to come to release them. So nobody had told them what heaven is like. That's why Jesus says nobody's seen heaven except the one who came from heaven, who was him. And so then he started, Matthew, the gospel, is full of stuff about heaven. Heaven is like this, heaven is like this, heaven is like that. You know? And so he was the one who actually taught us what to expect in heaven. And you know, and like Jesus says, in my Father's house there are many mansions. He doesn't say huts. See, there are many mansions. Mm-hmm. So he's saying, we got good things in store for you. You know, you might have a hard time here. Mm-hmm. You might have a lot of troubles and a lot of suffering. But when you get there, got you covered, you know.
How about today? Do most Jews believe in the afterlife?
Yeah, I think
they
so.
They do, yeah.
Sure.
Okay.
Do they?
Yeah. I think most Jews do, yeah. It was only the Sadducees that didn't. The Pharisees and the scribes and all believed in an afterlife.
Because I'm just thinking, I grew up in Manhattan in the big apartment building. And my grandmother, we knew all the neighbors. Got a lot of half-Jewish, half-German Jews come over. And grandma used to say, a lot of them in those days didn't really believe. And she said, you're going to be so surprised when you wake up on the other side, you know. But, I mean, that's just a few people in an apartment building.
Right.
It's not.
Well, think of the time. Think of the time, too. That was after the World War II.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And after World War II, you had a lot of this stuff happening because the Jews, so a lot of them could not deal with the Holocaust. How could God care about us and want us to live with him if he put us through the Holocaust? You know, so a lot of Jews lost their faith in the Holocaust. And so we saw that happening.
Okay.
But and that's why I'm always so, I admire so much any Jew who still is an observant Jew today, given what they have been through throughout their history.
Yeah.
You know, that just really, that just impresses the heck out of me, that they can hang still in there, you know, and still try to follow the law and everything else. Yeah. That's just really impressive.
Yeah, that's hope. That's, yeah. That could put us to shame sometimes, like
John Paul
Jewish
did.
Hope.
John Paul was the same way, you know?
Yeah.
When he grew up in Poland, Poland was like half Jewish and half Catholic, right? He had a lot of Jewish friends. He was in the theater there in his young life, and he had a lot of Jewish friends. So every year, he would invite his Jewish friends to the Vatican for a dinner. And he would tell them, be proud of your Jewishness. Be proud of the fact that you still believe in God. You're still hanging in there. You're still observing.
Yeah.
And, you know, other Jewish people who have become Catholic have said, you can't be more Jewish than to be Catholic.
Yeah.
You know, because it's the fulfillment of everything you're looking for. So it doesn't tell you to put everything that was Jewish behind you, because we still use the...
It's the foundation.
Yes. It's the foundation. They're our spiritual big brothers.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, you have a bond with
each other.
Yeah. I had a lot of Jewish friends growing up.
Right.
And you did. You had some kind of a bond.
Sure. And so all Jesus did would add to it. He didn't take it away. And my mother used to tell me all the time growing up, all a Catholic is a Jew who believes the Messiah.
Damn.
You know?
It's true.
So,
and the Jewish converts now call themselves Messianic Jews, right?
Yeah, a lot of them, yeah. Exactly. Sure. So as the author sees that the main reference point for observing the law, and therefore which should most interest the wise man, is the worship to God in the temple of Jerusalem. So he's really big on worshiping in the temple. That's where God lives for them. He resides in the temple, just like he resides in our tabernacles. Ben Sirach is interested in the temple liturgy because it is a model of what man's relationship with God should be. It is his guide for leading a moral life. Worship and morality are interconnected. This was something that the prophets of Israel had laid great stress on. Worship was false if the worshiper was not striving to lead an upright life. And that's a really important concept, because we see it even in our own time, when you see the guys in the mafia taking their children to church to get baptized while they're putting out a hit on somebody, you know. I mean, it's, you know, and so he's saying that isn't living a true life. How you worship should be how you live. There shouldn't be a dichotomy there. Another outstanding feature of Ben Sirach is his awareness of the providence of God in giving his people faithful men and women who provided leadership and set an example for others by their loyalty to covenant and law. And we do that today, trying to encourage people into the priesthood and religious life. In God's providential plan, the life of the individual, therefore, has a social dimension and an importance for the entire people. Finally, to sum up, we can say that in the complex and extensive 10:14, okay, it's the second time. I don't want to run us over. We can say that in the complex and extensive treatment given these subjects in the text, we can see that it carries an important message about wisdom. On the one hand, it depicts wisdom as something divine and all-embracing. That is to say, wisdom resides in God. It is God himself who has imbued all creatures, all created things with it. On the other hand, it sees wisdom as something that is the endowment of the chosen people. They are its privileged recipients. They receive wisdom through reason, but also through following the law of God. It is through Israel that God offers that wisdom, which is meant for all the people of the earth. So in Ben Sirach's mind, the wisdom that God wants to give all of mankind is coming through Israel, through Judaism, through the law of God. And so he sees Israel as the source of that for the entire world. And that's a kind of interesting idea. And that's what I think a lot of the early Jewish converts to Christianity were confused about. Because they asked the question, do you have to become Jewish first before you can become a Christian? If we could be baptized. So there was a big question, you know, and that's why they had the apostles coming together to answer those questions. You know, can I be baptized without becoming Jewish? And so they came to the right answer, you know, because their history and traditions were such an important part with somebody that came from somewhere else, from Spain or Greece or France or something else, would not have any of that background. So none of the Jewish history would mean anything to them. So can they become a child of God and follow the law without all that, for them, baggage? And the apostle said, yes, we can do that.
And circumcision, right? Remember there was big discussion, should they be circumcised before they come in?
Well, see, for a Christian, baptism is the equivalent of circumcision. Only as it was sacramentalized. Circumcision was how you became a child of God. And then a husband would convey that to his wife when they had intercourse. And that's why she is the source of Judaism, because then she passes that to the child. There's a whole spirituality for that. If you ever guys want to go into that, let me know. We can do a whole class on that stuff.
I can skip that.
It's really interesting. There's a whole class we can do on the interesting incense that they used, and what it meant, what's the spirituality behind the incense, and then prayer shawls that they had. What's the spirituality behind that? You know, what does that mean for them and all? So if you want to do any of that stuff, let me know. Anyway, there's a section here on which might be worth just briefly looking at. It's called Sirach in the Light of the New Testament, and its reception in the Christian tradition. And so he says, the book of Ben Sirach, although it's never quoted formally, seems to be echoed in many New Testament passages. In the words of our Lord reported in the Gospels, in exhortations in the letters of St. Paul and in St. James. Then he says, Matthew 11:28 says, come to me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. I take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly of heart, and stuff. And that's reminiscent of Sirach 6:24-25 and 51:26-27. So when we get to those, I made notes when we get there to go back to this page so you can see what the difference there. And then John 4:13-14, when he's talking to the woman at the well, everyone who drinks of this water will thirst again, but whoever drinks of the water that I shall give him will never thirst. It's somewhat like Sirach 24:21-22. And I did the same thing there, so we can look back on that. And then we saw in the Book of Wisdom how they talked about personifying wisdom. We saw that, you know, a few times, if you remember. And he does the same thing here. He says, similarly, the personification of wisdom in Sirach 24, taken with Proverbs 8 and Wisdom 7, gives some insight into Jesus as divine wisdom incarnate. So wisdom does become personified in Christ, in his incarnation.
But the references are always to wisdom as a woman, aren't they?
Yeah. But it's also God,
right,
who is genderless.
Right.
Do you ascribe wisdom to the Holy Spirit, or?
Yeah. Yeah. And we see that reflected in the prologue of John's Gospel. In the beginning was Word, was with God, was with God, etc. In Paul's hymn to Christ's primacy over all creation, in the letter to the Colossians, chapter 1, or in the opening verses of the letter to the Hebrews, chapter 1, verses 1 and 2. St. James, in his letter, says a number of things that are reminiscent of the book of Sirach, one of the most obvious being his exhortation about control of the tongue, which seems to evoke Sirach 28. You know, just watch what you say. When I was practicing law, we had a judge that used to always say, you can't unring a bell. What you say or what you do is done. You can't go back and undo it. The ecclesiastical writers of the first centuries and the fathers often used passages of Ben Sirach to support their preaching. This is particularly true of those pastors and catechists who sought to educate Christians in sound moral doctrine. For example, Clement of Alexandria and St. Gregory the Great, and St. Ambrose and St. Augustine quote the book hundreds of times. So we see that a lot. In the liturgy of the church, passages from Sirach are used on some Sundays and also during the weekly cycle. We should mention as being particularly important the application to Jesus Christ of wisdom in the second Sunday after the Nativity, The divine office also includes passages of Sirach as canticles for morning prayer on Monday of the second week, etc. So you see a lot of references to things that kind of morph from Sirach into, even though the direct quotes are not there, the same idea, the same concept is there. So the prologue. The prologue was not part of Ben Sirach's... Is it? We've got 10 minutes. Okay. The prologue was not part of the book. It says very short. But it was written by the grandson of the fellow who wrote the Book of Wisdom. Okay. And the prologue was not part of the original work. It was written by the grandson as an introduction to the Greek translation made by him. So it was written originally in Hebrew. He translated it to Greek and then wrote a prologue for that Greek edition. The prologue contains information that helps to situate the Book of Sirach in its historical, cultural, and literary context. Whether or not these verses are divinely inspired has been a subject of much debate. The fact that it is to be found in manuscript and printed editions of the book would argue that it is. The translation points out explicitly, though at no great length, the main feature of the book. It was written that those who love learning should make even greater progress in living according to the law. So it's got a bunch of more notes in the prologue, but let's just look at the prologue. The prologue begins, "Whereas many great teachings have been given to us through the law and the prophets and the others that followed them, on account of which we should praise Israel for instruction and wisdom. And since it is necessary not only that the readers themselves should acquire understanding, but also that those who love learning should be able to help the outsiders by both speaking and writing. My grandfather Jesus, after devoting himself especially to the reading of the law and the prophets and the other considerable proficiency in them, was himself also led to write something pertaining to instruction and wisdom. In order that by becoming conversant with this also, those who love learning should make even greater progress in living according to the law." He says it's necessary not only that the readers themselves should acquire understanding. I found that an interesting statement to make because he's talking about the readers. Mm-hmm. Most people in that time were illiterate.
Read, right.
But he's assuming that there's a culture in Israel that encourages education and reading, because you would read the law, you know, and stuff like this. And so he's assuming that most of the people in Israel would be readers, which I thought was an interesting idea, which you don't find around the rest of the world, you know?
Yeah.
Except possibly in Greece. Because the Greek philosophers. In fact, when the Romans captured Greek cities, they would take prisoners and make them the tutors for their children, because they were already learned. It was very valuable to have a Greek slave in your house.
They became teachers.
Yeah.
It says, "You are urged, therefore, to read with goodwill and attention, and to be indulgent in cases where, despite our diligent labor in translating, we may seem to have rendered some phrases imperfectly. But what was originally expressed in Hebrew does not have exactly the same sense when translated into another language. Not only this work, but even the law itself, the prophecies, and the rest of the books differ not a little as originally expressed. When I came to Egypt in the 38th year of the reign of Eugertes and stayed for some time, I found opportunity for no little instruction. It seemed highly necessary that I should myself devote some pains and labor to the translation of the following book, using in that period of time great watchfulness and skill in order to complete and publish the book for those living abroad who wish to gain learning, being prepared in character to live according to the law." So he translated it into Greek. He did it because that was basically the educational and commerce language of the world at the time. Mm-hmm. Later it became Latin, but at the time it was Greek. So if you wanted to do commerce around the world, you learned Greek. And at this time, most of the people, if we saw it before in one of our classes, most of the people in Israel, when they came back from the exile, were speaking Greek because they were forced to learn Greek while they were in exile. So a lot of them no longer could read Hebrew. So the rabbis had to read the Hebrew for them. We saw that in one of our other readings. Mm. So he was one of the people that learned the Greek. So he's saying, we got a lot of people out there in the world, you know, in Syria and Greece and Mesopotamia and everything, that don't know Hebrew. Some have translated it to Greek so they could have the benefit of the wisdom of my grandfather. And so that's what they did. And with that, it brings us to 10:30. Just about. And so we will begin part one next time of the Book of Sirach with that background. I hope the background was helpful to you.
That was good.
I thought it was very informative.
Very.
And it really gives you an insight into what we're going to be looking at and why it was written the way it was written and everything else.
I'm looking here. It wasn't accepted by the Protestants. Anything big stands out that they didn't accept?
Right, because it was written in Greek.
Oh, okay.
Okay. The original Hebrew they didn't find.
Okay.
But then they found it.
Right.
So that whole argument went out the window.
Okay. Also, you were talking about the prologue.
Yeah.
But my book, do you have the prologue written out? Mm-hmm. See, I don't, which I can't understand. I mean, it starts with the Wisdom of Sirach, chapter 1. I just want to see what your Bible looks like.
Yeah, I'm getting... doesn't have
it. Oh, look at that. Then this isn't... Yeah.
You got a bad Bible.
I don't have a Protestant Bible. No. Left over from my husband. Right? No.
But it's a New American Bible.
The New American?
Yeah. They have a lot of stuff in there.
There's your excuse to get a lighter New
Right,
Bible.
Right. This is not... I'm not... What is your book?
RSV. RSV. Yeah. That's right?
Oh, with the Ignatius, the Holy Bible. I got to write that down because I'll forget when I go home. Ignatius.
And it's light because it's paperback.
Yeah. And it's very... It's done by Scott Hahn.
It's so heavy. You said that once before.
Yeah,
Ignatius.
It's a good addition.
The Holy Bible.
Anybody else have any questions or thoughts or ideas on what we
covered
today?
Revised Standard
Edition.
Yeah, Revised.
Okay, well then we're finished for the day. We shall see you next week. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
And have a great week.
Thank you. Thank you, Jim. Okay.